So this is Captain Buxton, Reel 1. Can you tell me what you were doing before war broke out?
I had just had 1 year at Trinity College, Cambridge, studying maths, and in that year I'd been connected with the what's called the Cambridge Intercollegiate Christian Union, and in the beginning of August many of them went to different seaside places and had sand missions for the children, and I was with a party on the Isle of Wight. When war broke out, everybody thought that the Germans were landing on the Isle of Wight in the next few hours, but we finished our fortnight with tremendous crowds of adults in the evening coming to hear talks, and then within the month I joined up.
Did any of the local population on the Isle of Man do anything in anticipation of a possible German invasion?
As far as we could see, I would have said no. There was a kind of feeling that this is hopeless. They're coming anyway, but there may have been more than I saw. Mm-hmm. But as we were dealing with the shore, I think we'd have seen anything that was done immediately near Sea View where we were. Mm-hmm.
One thing which interests me is that, as a keen Christian, you must have found yourself in something of a sort of moral dilemma at the outbreak of war. Should you take up arms? Should you consider killing people? How did you resolve that? Or was it a dilemma?
That's a very good question, because the Buxton family have great Quaker background. And as you know, the Quakers, called the Friends now, don't believe in war. But during that time, one was naturally trying to find out what the Bible said, and it was interesting to find how many battles in the Old Testament were by the word of the Lord. And in the New Testament, neither John the Baptist nor our Lord ever said anything against a soldier, only told them to do their job within the limits of war. And when Paul wanted a picture of a good Christian, he couldn't possibly have said, be a good prostitute. He did say, be a good soldier of Jesus Christ. And these things in my young mind built up to a confidence that if death was abroad, if wrong was to be resisted, the Christian should be right in amongst it.
Mm. Was there any debate, exchange of views between you and your fellow Christians at this time? Any differences of opinion?
Perhaps? I don't remember, but you may be amused to realize, which I hadn't remembered before, J.E. Hall was one of that party, and his mother and daughter, who was later a missionary in Japan, were on the island for their holidays. So it was rather interesting that he was there. I think he was there, at least, I'd better say. Mm.
Did the question arise in your mind at the time of objection to the war on moral, humanitarian, or religious grounds? Did you meet people, for example, who held this opinion, which might have led them to take up a different position to you?
Certainly later, but in that first month I would have doubted. We were busy with the mission for the children while they were out of bed, so to speak, and we would have big open airs for the adults, and I don't remember discussing that. But later, of course, one met people who didn't quite know which way to go, and some who felt very strongly for religious reasons, others for political reasons, that they wouldn't take part. Mm.
Amongst this kind of people, would you know whether there were different kind of stances and different kinds of opinions that they held which gave them a reason for not involving themselves in the war?
I think really at that stage I was so young that I wasn't really thinking it through except for myself. Mm.
What I was wondering was whether people objected for a variety of reasons or whether it was concentrated purely on one particular argument.
Well, I think there were some who were purely political conscientious objectors. But from the Christian point of view, I think people took that phrase, "thou shalt not kill," which I'm told both in the Old Testament in Hebrew and the New Testament in the Greek, is a very different word. It's "thou shalt not murder," which is taking the law into your own hands. And unfortunately, it was translated the way in which the word has changed its meaning a little. And therefore, the matter of kill did seem to be final to some people.
Hmm. What about the political ones? What was their philosophy for not joining up?
That I would find difficult to answer now, because one is so coloured by the fact that now the people who are against are communists because they don't want England to survive. I don't think I really remember then. I was only a young freshman at Cambridge and hadn't very, I don't remember very clear views on that matter.
Reading the history books of the First World War and the pre-First World War period, it seems as if the signposts to war and the outbreak of war were pretty obvious, but I wonder whether that's the sort of wisdom of hindsight. How obvious, when war broke out, was it to you? How had you expected it?
I don't think really hardly anybody in the nation, except people with a great inside knowledge, had expected it. But it was rather striking that my mother-in-law later, she was my mother-in-law, had told her family months before that Bible prophecy suggested that Israel would be going back to Palestine in 1917 and that she believed that war would be 3 years before that.
Mm.
And they used to laugh at her and say, "When is Mother's war?" Because she had expected it in April. And it very much interested her that later Churchill said that the inner people knew by April 1914 that war was inevitable.
Mm.
You ask, what did we know? I was interested, when my son was reading history, he was asked to write a thesis on that which caused the 1914 war starting in 1850. So historians had a long way back at which they could see roots.
I'm less interested in the historian's sort of philosophy
than
in your personal, and more interested in your personal reaction.
My personal reaction was that I don't think I did much thinking on it, and later I was interested when I married my wife to hear this about her mother.
Mm. So what you're saying is that in general war came as a surprise to you?
Yes, certainly, and we were quite clear that Germany would be defeated by the 7th of October when we would go back to Cambridge.
Can you remember in the Isle of Man any sort of general reaction to the outbreak of war, what the sort of tenor of it was?
Well, I would have said it was a tremendous turning to hear what God had to say. We were only young fellows, and yet we would have 500 people, perhaps more, gather to hear us talk, which was quite extraordinary. In a sense, we were people of no knowledge or authority, but they were urgent to know what God said and whether God would intervene and help.
Mm-hmm. Now, when you had taken the decision to involve yourself personally in the war, you joined the 1st East Anglian Field Ambulance, first of all.
Yes.
Well, where did you go there to join up with
them? We went to Bury St. Edmunds, and I joined them because my cousin Patrick Buxton was a medical student and had been called up to it, and he wrote to me and said, "We do want people who can handle wounded well. Come and join us."
Mm-hmm.
And I joined. It was something I'd get into at once.
Did this period would the 1st East Anglian Field Ambulance give you any sense of being in the war? To what extent did it bring home the realities of war to you?
Well, we joined up on the cricket ground of the school in Bury St Edmunds without tents or anything. We just found our blade of grass and put a ground sheet over us. But then, after I'd been given elementary training, about a month, with a lot of marching to get fit, they took me to the hospital that had been built on King's College Cricket Ground, Cambridge, where I actually dressed men who had actually been wounded. I very well remember one man who had been in the charge in which Captain Grenville and his brother both received a VC. And it did show one the tremendous mess a man could get into with wounds.
Mm-hmm.
And later, it was of enormous value to me as a company commander that the stretcher bearers knew I knew about their work, and it gave them confidence when things were rather overwhelming.
Mm. Now, this was quite a short period for you with the East Anglian Field Ambulance before you transferred to the infantry with a yes. with a commission. Why did you transfer to the infantry?
I had a great friend at Cambridge, Covey Barrett, whose father was agent to Lord Hothfield in Skipton, and he wrote and said that they very much needed second lieutenants, particularly if they'd had any education, and would I come? And it seemed to me that it was the right thing to go there. I think one was impressed with the fact that a Christian should go where there was danger, because he believed that through faith in Christ the future was undertaken for.
Mm. Mm.
And so I went with to them.
Were there any other reasons why you felt it was the right thing for you to do? I was thinking particularly of whether you felt, by virtue of your education and sort of position in society, this was a kind of thing that was required of you.
I don't think, so to speak, the position in society had a point, but I was pressed by the letter that Covey Barrett wrote in the name of the colonel, that they did want men who would take care of their men, who would be thoughtful, and it seemed to me that this was better than being a better usefulness than being just a private,
mm-hmm.
Having somewhat come to the end of the training that they gave.
Now, you were commissioned direct into the Duke of Wellington's regiment,
yes.
as an infantry subaltern.
Yes.
How well equipped did you feel to take up the duties of a platoon commander with which you were immediately given?
This question certainly shows up how entirely unprepared the politician had allowed the army to be for the situation. I had learned a certain amount of drill with the ambulance, of course, and in the 3 hours train journey I worked hard at my drill book, and I was glad I did, because the first day I was on parade, I had to command the men. And I learnt as I went, as everybody else did. There were no training places for prospective officers. You went straight in.
Yeah. What's your view now of this practice of commissioning officers more or less direct from civilian life?
I don't think that where you had keen senior officers, there was any loss. You did get that tremendously keen volunteer spirit. But of course, when you're dealing with life and death, it is far better to be thoroughly trained first, obviously. But that wasn't possible in those days.
Now, the 6th Battalion, which you joined was a territorial force. What was the... Can you give me some idea of the age and experience of the officers and NCOs who were Colonel, the 6th Battalion?
Colonel Burbeck had been in command of a half-caste battalion in the South African War, and he was as tough as you would expect him to be. Then there were...
Was he a regular officer?
No, still? He was a territorial.
Yes, I see.
Then there were company commanders... some of whom were, all of whom were businessmen who had given their time in peace and without any derogatory words, some of them were getting a bit old for the battle of physical endurance that was coming, and one or two of them dropped out or were, when we got to France, made what was described as town majors. Mm-hmm. They looked after the building. But some of them served right through, and one particularly went to command a regular battalion. There were some very efficient fellows amongst them.
Yes. Was there a leavening of regular officers and NCOs?
There was an adjutant who was a regular, a very quiet, awfully nice man, and there was the regular regimental sergeant major who was absolutely first class and must have been a tremendous help to the NCOs, as he also was to us second lieutenants, mm-hmm. because he was sufficiently human to be able to ask him of things.